Breakfast at Sally's, written by Richard Lemieux. Chapter 8, Dr. Z. With C as my tour guide to the many free meals in the city, my ache for sustenance over the next few weeks was largely appeased. But there were many other aches and pains that a large helping of tuna noodle casserole could not soothe. A doctor at the Department of Health Services had diagnosed me as suffering clinical depression. He passed me on to the other physicians to see if I was salvageable. The journey back, or forward, or sideways, I was not sure which direction I was going to be, was about to become more complicated and intriguing with each day. I felt adrift in the raging river of life. Occasionally, I could grasp the branch of a fallen tree for a rest from the torrent, but the respite was always brief, and the churning waters would then carry me away again. I could never quite reach the shore. I had gone to the library to keep warm and to dry and to read every book available on depression, only to find the process even more depressing. The state sent me to Dr. Z for a look-see. They called him Dr. Z because most of the patients could neither spell nor say his last name correctly. Dr. Z was my doc because he was the only physician in town at the time who would accept Medicaid, which paid considerably below the going rate other doctors wanted for each visit. Dr. Z's office was just about filled with poor people when I arrived one morning in March for a 10 a.m. appointment. Children who were sneezing, coughing, and obviously running fever sat in their mothers' laps. Four little old ladies were mostly staring off into space, though occasionally taking a peek at a middle-aged man rocking back and forth in his chair while mumbling some indistinguishable words. I checked in at the desk. "Do you have an insurance card?" the receptionist asked. "Yes," I replied, pulling the Medicaid card from my pocket and handing it to her. "Please fill this out," she said, handing me a clipboard that contained a patient information form. "Here's a pen, too," she held it out to me. "I need to make a copy of your card," she added as I walked away. I settled in a chair along the wall, crossing my legs, and began filling out the form. Name, Richard Lemieux. Address, none. Phone, none. Mother and father, deceased. Children, none. Relative or friend to contact in case of emergency, none. Allergies, current or past infections or illnesses that require treatment, none. Current medications, none. I got up and returned to the desk and handed the receptionist the clipboard. She handed my medical card back to me. "Someone will be with you shortly," she said with a smile. I then went looking for some reading material on the racks. There was no Bon Appetit, Red Book, People, Golf, or Travel and Leisure. There were a few AARP magazines, but I didn't want those. The book collection consisted mostly of Dr. Seuss classics. I grabbed The Cat in the Hat, took it back to my seat, opened the book, and started reading. I had just gotten past the sit, 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 sit part and was moving on to the real excitement when the nurse interrupted my reading. "Richard? Richard Lemieux?" She was standing by the entrance to the chamber that would lead to Dr. Z's examining room. I got up and took Dr. Seuss with me, which drew a smile from two of the old ladies still sitting patiently in their chairs. "Hello, I'm Jane," the nurse said, pushing the door open and revealing the long hallway to Dr. Z's clinic. "Let's go to room number 2. She briskly led the way. "Hop up on that examining table and please take off your shirt," Nurse Jane said, reaching for a dressing gown and holding it up for me. "You may put this on." She began going through her nursing routine of strapping a blood pressure apparatus around my arm and squeezing the ball. "So why are you here today?" she asked. "I'm here for depression," I replied, as I felt the pressure on my arm increase with each pump of the ball in Nurse Jane's hand. "Depression, huh?" she said.
Why do you feel you are depressed?
I tried to commit suicide a little while ago, and, I didn't. Well,
that's okay, dear,
Jane interrupted, and she put her hand on my shoulder. Then she turned and picked up the clipboard and wrote something down.
How are you feeling today?
She asked. Well, I've been sleeping in my car for a few months, and I'm a little tired, but...
Here, open up,
she interrupted again, pointing a thermometer toward my mouth.
Your blood pressure is just fine,
she said, grabbing the clipboard and writing again.
The doctor will be able to help you,
she assured me, taking the thermometer with her hand and checking its reading.
Temperature is fine, too.
Then Nurse Jane wheeled around and opened the door.
The doctor will be with you soon, she said.
I went back to reading Dr. Seuss. Juggling fish bowls, bottles of milk, and birthday cakes, I wondered if Seuss was on the pipe when he wrote this stuff. Was there a subliminal message being passed on, like, let your soul out to play? Or was he just messing with the minds of the parents who would be reading this book to their children, parents who might secretly want some chaos in an otherwise too orderly universe? C is just like the Cat in the Hat, I thought. Entering a room, he could turn the boring and mundane into something bizarre, or at least exciting. He'd turn things upside down and make a mess with his words and deeds. He would even try to walk on water from time to time and move mountains with his faith, either of which could have earned him a room in the mental hospital if reported. He could turn even an uneventful shopping trip into an adventure. C had asked me one day to take him to the store to get some supplies for the armadillo. We went to Walmart, where we were greeted cordially at the door. C bowed at the waist and then went down on one knee before the greeter, saying, "Greetings to you, too." I should have run right then. As we cruised down aisle 2B, C spotted a young, blonde sales associate with red vest approaching us, her ill-fitting half-heel slapping the tiled floor. Her name tag, Victoria. "Pardon me, darling," C said, stopping her in her tracks. "Can you tell me where to find the camp stove gas canisters?"
"Sporting goods, follow me,"
Victoria commanded and turned to lead the parade, her heels rhythmically clicking on the tiles. She led us past bed and bath, through pet supplies, and then breezed by automotive to sporting goods.
"Here they are," she pointed to the canisters. "And you're lucky. They're on sale for $1.09,
she added, pointing to the happy face sign. "Whoa," C responded, $1.09. I pay $2.60 a piece for these at the hardware store."
"Our everyday low price at Walmart is only $1.99,
Victoria boasted. "Well, it's no wonder, darling, that you people can't afford to have health insurance and can barely afford to live," replied C. That comment took the perk right out of the sales associate. Victoria's green eyes opened wide and she stiffened. Without comment, she turned and stomped away, her shoes clapping even more loudly on the floor. "Gosh, I hope she wasn't offended," he said to me as he picked up the gas canisters. "Next, some Palmolive dish soap." We set off on the next part of the journey, unguided. As we were leaving that department, I noticed out of the corner of my eye that we were under surveillance by a middle-aged man in a white shirt and tie. I instinctively recognized him as a management type and suspected that C's comment had been duly reported. My only hope was to get C out the door as quickly as possible. "Do they have caramel corn here?" C asked. "I like caramel corn late at night." "Probably," I said, looking over my shoulder for the man in the white shirt and tie. Just as we were closing in on the caramel corn, I saw another man in a white shirt and a tie at the end of the aisle. This one was wearing a bright red vest and was watching us. He stepped out of sight after I made eye contact. Now I knew we were in trouble. After all, C had a case of gas canisters in his arm. We could be terrorists, or worse yet, communists. I suspected cameras were recording our every move,
and I feared our profiles were being scanned and sent by satellite to Homeland Security. Having finally reached our objective, C grabbed a bag of caramel corn off the shelf.
"I also need some of those long kitchen matches," he muttered.
I took a deep breath, and he stopped.
"On second thought," he said, "I think I have enough matches to get by. Let's get out of here. I actually feel bad shopping here. I feel like I'm doing something wrong."
I breathed a sigh of relief. I hoped we would escape this institution without further incident. Unfortunately, as we rounded the corner of aisle 27A, I saw the long line at checkout stand 5, the only line open in the middle of a shift change. We got in line. The lady in front of us had a cart full of grape and lime juice boxes, 3 cases of Pampers, 6 packages of Lunchables, bologna and cheese snacks, and 8 cans of dog food. Another woman slipped into line behind us with a 24-pack of chocolate chip cookies. And behind her, an elderly lady pulled in with a cart filled with Spam, boxes of Velveeta, cat food, a bag of cat litter, and a cat scratching post. It was in that line, just as I placed the plastic divider bar on the conveyor belt so we could put his goods down, that C's conscience got to him.
"No, no, I can't do this," he began, berating himself. "I've got to put this stuff back. Buying here is destroying the very fabric of man, enslaving people in low-wage jobs."
His voice began to grow louder. "These people can't afford to live on what they are making here," he continued, pointing to the sales associates. He glanced down, took a deep breath, and let forth a yell.
"Attention! Attention, Walmart shoppers! We are having a special on conscience today, and it's free. It will make you feel good. It will make you smile. Please join me in putting your stuff back and agreeing not to shop here until they get their employees health insurance and a living wage."
I looked around. Beneath all the smiley face price rollback signs was a sea of snarls of Walmart shoppers' faces. They were not about to put back their $5.99 slippers or any of their other newly found treasures. The greeters had all gathered at the end of checkout stand 5 with a chorus of frowns and a white shirt and tie brigade converging on C. "We must ask you to leave, sir," said one, followed quickly by another adding, "or we will have to call the police."
"I will be more than happy to accommodate you, sirs," said C, producing a Cheshire cat grin.
He turned and strode toward the door, leaving his gas canisters, Palmolive of soap and caramel corn lying on the conveyor belt. I could tell by his stride that he was pleased with himself. He had made his point. I heard the sound of the door handle in the small examining room turn, and the door opened slowly. Dr. Z peeked in to make sure someone was in the room. He looked at me over his glasses. "Hello," he stepped in and closed the door behind him and started reading the chart Nurse Jane had given him.
"Depression, suicide attempt."
Dr. Z looked at me.
"Not good," he observed.
I nodded in agreement.
"Well, we can fix that," he said matter-of-factly, and he took a small flashlight out of his coat pocket and pointed it in my eyes, placing his left hand on the side of my face.
Eyes left. I noticed the frayed collar on his white shirt and the missing button.
"Eyes right,"
I complied.
"Look down."
Then I noticed the tassel was missing from his well-worn right brown Oxford shoe. I thought to myself, poor Dr. Z chose the wrong specialty for making money in the new millennium. He should have gone for breasts. 300,000 women, including 18,000 girls under the age of 18, had bought, mostly charged, breast implants in 2002. At $4,000 to $6,000 per job, it added up to $2.4 billion. If Dr. Z had gone that route, he would have been able to buy a new pair of loafers and a new smock. My mind was wandering. I wondered what
Madame Curie would say about all those breast implants. Dr. Z scribbled something on my chart again and then laid it down. He searched through his smock pockets, first the top, then the lower right. I thought he looked depressed. The sole of his left shoe was beginning to separate from the uppers. His maroon tie was spotted. He found what he was searching for, a prescription pad, in the same pocket where his pen had been. He then quickly wrote out the script and handed it to me. I lowered my head, looking at the small piece of paper. "I'm going to give you Zoloft," he said. "Take it twice a day and get lots of sleep." He reached out and put a hand on my shoulder as he spoke reassuringly. "We are going to make you feel better." He turned around, pulled a paper cup from the dispenser on the wall, and filled it at the sink. He set the cup down, saying, "I'll be right back." He dashed out the door and was back in seconds. "I've got some samples to get you started today," said Dr. Z, tearing open a box and then pressing a small pastel green pill out of its plastic holder into the palm of my hand. He handed me the pill in the water. I put the pill in my mouth and washed it down. "Well, just about everybody is on some drug nowadays," I thought to myself. "Rush Limbaugh is on pain pills. Barry Bonds is hitting record-breaking home runs on steroids. Half the NFL is on something. And who knows what the NBA players are using or what Michael Jackson is taking at his Neverland ranch." I knew the next step from my readings at the library. Dr. Z and I both knew that many suicide suitors who have failed try again as soon as they get a little boost from the pills. I wondered if maybe Dr. Z could concoct a capsule so powerful that I would be changed into the Millennium Man, a modern-day Wyatt Earp, with a cell phone strapped to one hip and a beeper attached to the other, armed for battle. I would wear a radio headset tuned in to Rush Limbaugh and have my laptop in one hand and my compass set in the other so I could find my way home at night. With all batteries fully charged, I would be plugged into the world. I would be pumped up with 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C, 500 of B, 200 of E, 2 aspirin for my heart, and I would carry Viagra in my pocket, just in case. My wife would be a real estate baroness, off closing a house deal. She would have all the toothbrushes charging, the house alarm on, and the OnStar system set in the car. Her pillbox would be filled with pain pills and other supplements marked for every day of the week. She would have the TiVo set to record Dr. Phil at 2 and the microwave set to start dinner at 5. The windows would all be duct taped and our guns loaded. The kids would be safe at school or on their way to their bowling class. Everything would be perfect. And maybe if I took 2 or 3 of Dr. Z's miracle pills, I could quickly move up in the world and become a Tony Robbins with my own late-night TV infomercial, sharing the secrets of my success, explaining how I, Ricardo, of course I have changed my name, became a multi-billionaire in just 6 months by buying up foreclosed bungalows with no money down and selling them for 4 times their worth. And how you can do it too with my step-by-step motivational books and CDs, only $19.99. They teach you how to foreclose, how to toss people in the street, and even how to sleep at night after doing it. If you get good enough, you might be able to buy a brunette. Or maybe Dr. Z's drugs could get me the whole enchilada. I could design and build my own city and name it after myself. I could give my subjects a pill every morning and they would race from one end of town to the other all day, gathering resources for me, which I would send from my own port to China, where men, women, and children would work 21 hours a day for 10 cents an hour in my very own sweatshops, assembling plastic widgets to be sold at Walmart. I felt like Huck Finn must have felt at the end of his story when Aunt Sally was going to adopt him and civilize him. Dr. Z's pill was now melting in my body. Would it civilize me? Like Huck, I had been there before. But as I said, I had read the books at the library and I knew my future, realizing that I was broken, irreparable, the state would find some garret to store me away in once and for all, crossing their fingers that I would not hurt myself or anyone else. Sometimes I would visit the swamp of despair and be sarcastic, angry, and morose. Sometimes my pills would stir the chemicals in my brain so that I could still dream of becoming the next great comedian, quarterback, or author. But in the end, I would know that I had fallen too far behind in the race of life. The cheering crowds would have gone home long before I reached the finish line. My tombstone would appropriately read DNF. Did not finish. I looked down at the sample package Dr. Z had handed me. There was a picture of what looked like an egg on its side, with a smile, or maybe a smirk, on its face, eyeing a ladybug flying through the air. It read Zoloft in big letters, with Sertiline HCL in parentheses. When I looked up, Dr. Z stood before me, peering over his spectacles again. "Come back in 1 week to see me," he said. "You will feel better." "As you wish," I said, and he smiled. Maybe he had seen the Princess Bride, too. I quickly slipped off the dressing gown and put on my shirt, thinking Dr. Z sure seemed confident that I would get better. I knew I would come back in a week. I didn't want to disappoint him. Hell, maybe I had found another angel. Nurse Jane had not yet returned to set up my next appointment, so I went back to reading The Cat in the Hat. Soon the door swung open again, and she came in asking, "How do you feel?" "I'm okay, I guess," I responded.
"What are you doing tomorrow?"
she asked. "Nothing," I said.
"Well, I made an appointment for you at Kitsap Mental Health at 10 a.m. for counseling," she informed me. "Can you make that okay?"
"I think so," I said.
"It's up behind the Fred Meyer store on the east side," she continued. "Do you know where that is?"
"I do," I responded. "I'll just have to try to find some gas money to get there." Jane took my hand and placed several rolled-up bills in it, gently closing my hand around the money.
"This should help you get a hotel room for the night and some gas,"
she kept holding my hand.
"Get a hot bath, some food that you pick out and like, and get a good night's sleep."
I don't know. My words choked off.
"You don't have to say anything," she interrupted me. "My husband is a doctor, and about 7 years ago he became so depressed that one day he just left home. It took me 3 months to find him. He was in Colorado, living on the streets. If someone had not helped him, he would have died."
She paused.
"Now let's get you out of here. Hop down off the table, and we'll see you in 1 week at 11 a.m.
She escorted me from the room with a reassuring smile on her face. I didn't open my hand to look at the money until I closed the door of Dr. Z's clinic. It held 4 20s, a 10, and 3 1s. Nurse Jane must have emptied her purse to help me. I walked to the van, opened the door, and told Willow the good news. "Willow, we are going to a motel for a night." I attempted to calculate in my mind just how far Nurse Jane's gift would carry us. $50 for a motel, $10 for a dinner, $10 for gas, $0.50 for a Zagnut bar, $1 for a hamburger for Willow, $0.89 for a classic Coke for later, and that left us $20 for the next day. So we headed out, first to Denny's for a chicken fried steak dinner with extra gravy, fries, a Coke, and a piece of coconut cream pie, then on to McDonald's for a Willow burger, and finally to the store before searching for a motel room. That's tonight's episode. At this point, we must break off our reading. You've been hearing Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Copyright in 2009. It is read with the permission of the publisher Skyhorse Publishing of New York. Join us next time on the bookshelf for Breakfast at Sally's. The bookshelf is produced and edited by Vern Windham. I'm Jeff Hazen.